You're listening to a press conference from the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health with Michael Minna, Assistant Professor of Epidemiology. This call was recorded at 12 p.m. Eastern Time on Friday, October 23rd.
Dr. Minna, do you have any opening remarks?
No.
All right. I guess we can get started then. First question.
Hi, thank you for taking our questions. This is in terms of the new COVID-19 cases that we're seeing. We're seeing a spike in those, the likes of what we saw in the summer. So what are your reactions to that and why is this happening? And then I have a quick follow-up after that.
Yeah, well, we're seeing just the beginning. So we're seeing a spike in those that is likely to greatly exceed what we saw in the summer. This is unfortunately wholly expected. This is because the virus, whether we want to believe it or not as a society, is a seasonal virus. And that's based both on the biology of the virus likely, as well as human behavior and sort of social structures and temperature and having to be indoors and such. So none of this is surprising, I think, and that's the frustrating part. We had an opportunity in the summer to use and leverage the decreased transmission of the virus during the summer months to prepare for the fall. We didn't do that at all. And now we're gonna have to live with the consequences of that, or some people won't live as a result. And so I think that this is how viruses like this work. We have failed to believe that as a federal government and this is we're really not in a good position at the moment to deal with this, and I think it's going to be extraordinarily hard to figure out how to deal with this in any reasonable way. Essentially, what has happened now is we had a chance to potentially get this virus under control so that we could have a fighting chance of safely opening up. We haven't done that. And now we are really left with impossible decisions. There is no right decision anymore. There's a decision of either remaining locked down and having political economic fallout come from that, or staying open and continuing to open and having health consequences as a result. There is truly no good solution anymore. I was saying this when we first locked down in the winter and spring of 2020, which was that that was gonna be our shot, that the society wasn't gonna be willing to lock down again. So we had to use it in the most beneficial and efficient way. We didn't do it then, we're still not doing it. And we're kind of just going through the slow slog of things sort of pseudo opening. And that I think is probably the worst way to really deal with this.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned seasonality and also sort of people not following public health measures. How can you distinguish between the two? How do you know when these surges are because of the coronavirus's seasonality or because people are not following health measures? You know, does seasonality suggest that the virus is more contagious this time of year or more dangerous?
Yeah, there's a lot of complexity in what drives seasonality. Some of it's like actual molecular biology. Some of it's how the immune system and the virus work during winter months, for example. And some of it is behavior in terms of, but like, you know, behavior that we can't really change. Like when it's colder, people go indoors. Even just, you know, once it hits 65, it's no longer comfortable for many people to be outside. And so we see greater congregation indoors. And all of that, so that those pieces that normally drive the seasonality of a virus are colliding at full speed with the reopening of society. And the going back to K-12 school, going back to universities, opening up businesses, more and more opening up restaurants because of COVID fatigue, because all of this was essentially expected. We knew months ago that it was going to come to this. And so what's happened is we now have seasonality roaring up, and that was expected. We have economic opening and school openings all kind of hitting headfirst into each other. And it's creating this perfect storm, in my opinion, of a perfect storm that will cause cases to continue to climb to, I really think we're just seeing the beginning. We have now exceeded or about to exceed the average number of cases we saw at the peak at any other time in this epidemic in this country. And we're barely into the fall.
Great, thank you.
Next question.
Hey, Dr. Minna, thanks for taking the time this morning. I'm actually really glad I got you because this is a question that I think you're well suited to answer. Just a couple days ago, the state of Florida's Division of Emergency Management announced that it's going to be using the Abbott Rapid test, the BinaxNOW Now test, as a default test at all of its state-run drive-through testing sites. They have said that they are going to recommend a PCR for people who drive up with symptoms and test negative on a rapid test. But it seems like, you know, the PCR is going to be available upon request, but the thing that you're going to drive up and kind of the default tests they're going to use on you is this Abbott test. They gave me a couple reasons as to why this change is happening. They say, you know, being able to get a positive result in 5 minutes, it draws more people in to get tested. They've been having a hard time, you know, getting participation in testing here in Florida. And they also, you know, the question I raised was how this might affect positivity, you know, given that we've been kind of using this as a benchmark, this metric, and would it skew it? And they claim, I'm not sure if it's legitimate, they didn't provide a lot of data to back it up, but they claim that they have a similar positivity with the antigen test as they do with the PCR test. So I just kind of wanted to throw that at you and have you unpack it. I think the main question I have is, do you think it's a good idea to use this rapid test in this setting? Again, it's a drive-up setting as opposed to like a surveillance. And what other concerns you might have about the other aspects of this that I mentioned?
Yeah, I think certainly what I've done a lot of research on in the last number of months and what I've spoken very widely about is that the real power in tests like the Abbott BinaxNOW and other rapid antigen tests is going to come from frequent testing. So a drive-through site is not going to be a rapid, is not going to be a frequent type of testing. You're not going to be having people drive through every 3 days. At least my expectation is that that's not happening.
Right.
And so, but that said, I am not particularly concerned that about, I think that the BinaxNOW and a lot of these, it's proving to work really quite well. So if it can draw more people in, if it can serve to catch more people, that's really all I care about. You know, for drive-through sites, if it's a public health program, the effort should be, you know, what can we do to catch and pull as many transmissible people out of the population as possible? I think that if people are more enticed, then I think they should be more enticed to go to get a test if they know that they're going to get a result in some reasonable amount of time. A lot of people don't want to wait 3 days and they'd rather just not get any test than wait 3 days for a result. Even 24 hours, you know, there's no, humans like immediate feedback. And so in that sense, these tests can be very powerful. The sensitivity of the tests has proven to be really very, very high. In particular, when used by trained professionals, I think that we can train the public to use them as well. But at the moment, when being used by trained professionals to read it, the sensitivity is up in the high 90-95% of cases are detected within the first 7 or so days of infection. And or of symptom onset. And so this is going to be used for asymptomatics, but the important piece is that the test doesn't care if you're asymptomatic or symptomatic. The test cares if you have a lot of virus in your nose. And that's what we care about if we're worried about people transmitting to other people. Yes, there's going to be fringe cases when people maybe will not be detected. But if this can catch even 90% of people who are transmitting the virus at the time when they get tested, then that's a win. You know, otherwise, if the test had to go to a lab to get PCR, they would, those people would probably go through that drive-through and then go to work or do whatever they were going to do that day and find out 24 hours or 48 hours later that they were, that they're infectious or infected. And they wouldn't actually even know from the PCR if it really means that they're infectious or not. Right. It could be an old infection that's continuing to linger with the PCR. So I think that with the right messaging, these tests can be used extremely powerfully to catch people who are infectious, let them know immediately, ask them to go home and isolate in the same way we do with any test. There are concerns that these tests are going to be rolled out in places or in ways that don't make a lot of sense. Certainly if I had my way and I had $30 billion, I would build a lot of these tests and I would get people to use them frequently at home. And I would message them appropriately and I'd get Apple and Google's marketing teams and Coca-Cola's marketing teams and whoever else needs to get on board to ensure that the public understands the role of these tests and how they're used. You know, there's been a lot of people who are concerned with these antigen tests when it comes to reporting because they aren't linked to any Department of Public Health system. They're just pieces of cardboard. I think that those are, for things like these drive-through sites, I really do hope that in these sort of well-situated setups, I hope that they're planning to report the results. There's no reason not to report these results. And I've heard that some people are saying, well, we won't report positive.
No, they've been reporting all antigen results at state-run testing sites. I guess the question is getting back to positivity, Dr. Minna, is that something to be concerned about, or do you think that that's kind of not a significant concern or outweighed by the benefit of the test?
No, I mean the sensitivity for detecting people who are positive is like 97%. If your goal is to detect people who are currently who really have virus in them, if they just, you know, if your goal is to detect people who have been infectious within the last month or so, then you want to use an RNA or even an antibody test. But this is, so it really just depends. And I think these drive-through sites are really public health measures to try to catch as many people who are infectious. And I think that if the trade-off is that we can do more of them and get results to people quicker, then I think that the math adds up to make it worthwhile.
Just one last question and then I'll let you get to the other reporters here. You know, one other question I heard from a local public health official. She said that she was concerned kind of what you were getting at with the messaging, that perhaps this would give people a false sense of security if they test negative and they're in that pre-infectious window. And they might, you know, go get a rapid test, test negative, be in that pre-infectious window and then go hang out with their grandmother or something. And that was her major concern. I mean, where do you kind of come down on that particular concern?
Well, that pre-infectious window is short, you know, and we really have to, this is where we don't have enough people taking a big step back and saying, what matters here? What matters here is the overall number of people we can find that are infectious. So if this means that we can scale up the number of tests tenfold, but we are missing a few people who otherwise would have been caught with a PCR test in that pre-infectious window, which would be it's really rare to find people in the pre-infectious window. I think people don't get that. If you look at the viral kinetics, it's like a 15-hour window when you're PCR positive, but not yet antigen positive. So what are the chances that somebody's gonna happen to drive through if they're taking a test once and they're asymptomatic, and they're taking a test once every few months through a drive-through, what are the chances that it's gonna happen to be in that like 15 to 24 hour window? Pretty slim. And right. So if you can increase testing because of the use of these tests, then all of a sudden it makes sense from a public health perspective. Maybe if you're only focusing on each individual that drives through, then sure, PCR is always going to be better, but PCR has a delay. So in that sense, it's not even better. If you're going out and you're going to visit your parents, you know, by the time, let's say you're like, we just have to do a simple thought experiment. And I'm taking time to talk about this because I think that people are just really missing the ball here. The simple thought experiment is this. you can be in that pre-infectious window on day one or day two. Let's say you start it on day two and you get a test here. You know, you on an antigen test, maybe you'll miss it when you would have caught it on a PCR test. But you know, if you go back a day, say that person just happened to show up at that drive-through one day earlier, maybe both tests would have missed it. You know, so it just doesn't, or you find out with PCR and you don't get a result for 48 hours, whereas if that person otherwise would have for just happenstance, you know, shown up a day later and gotten an antigen test, they would actually have gotten their result quicker than the 48 hour delayed PCR. So I think it's, people are really missing what are the trade-offs here. When you start to focus so much on each individual, that is absolutely the wrong thing to do for public health. Public health, you have to take a step back and say, what's the right program to catch the most people? And this issue of catching people at the pre-infectious stage, it's just really rare that we catch people in that window. If it was a 2-week period of time and we were able to catch everyone during that period of time, then sure, but that's not how this virus works.
Thank you so much, Dr. Min. I really appreciate you taking the time. Really helpful.
Absolutely.
Next question.
Hey, thanks for doing the call. Just want to know if you can comment generally on the hospital situation. Looks like they're filling up again in various states. Seems the good news is that treatments and clinical knowledge, it's probably better than it was in the spring, but the bad news is the virus is everywhere, including rural areas that might not have the same kind of capacity. So what's kind of the outlook heading into the winter in terms of being able to avoid bad outcomes? Thanks.
I'm really getting frustrated. Not with this call. It's just the outlook sucks. It really sucks. The benefit, like you say, the silver lining here, or we call it a silver lining, is that we truly are seeing drops in fatality rates. I do believe very strongly that's because we are learning how to treat these people. We're learning what are the right vent settings. We're learning how to position people. We're getting people on. We're learning what are the right cocktails of drugs to give so that we can help abrogate inflammatory responses that get out of control. So all of that's really important. And we're going to see more and more people live through the hospital stay. The problem is, to live through the hospital stay means that you're still going to the hospital. And so that means we're going to, you know, pre-hospital, people are still getting, nothing has changed with the virus. So we're still having these people land in the hospital. If we have too many people land in the hospital, then the hospitals get overloaded. You can't have a functioning society, in my opinion, if we don't have the availability of hospital beds for people. If we end up, even if everyone lives, let's say even if 100% of people lived through their ICU stay, if we don't have enough ICUs to get those people in, then people aren't gonna have a chance to live through their ICU stay because they won't make it into an ICU bed and event. We won't have a place for cancer patients to safely be able to go to the hospital if there's too many people with coronavirus in that hospital. So we're seeing these hospitals fill up, and they're just gonna keep filling up. Nothing has changed. Just because the infection fatality rate has gone down doesn't mean that the hospitals aren't gonna keep filling up. To get treated, you have to show up there. And I think, I hope that some of the cities are going to be doing better, but I agree. I mean, the rural areas and the heartland of the United States, Middle America, does not tend to have a ton of massive tertiary care hospitals, and their environments, you know, some pretty limited outbreaks can potentially cause these clinics and hospitals in much of the United States to quickly become overloaded. And this is areas of the country that are already short on physicians and medical staff. And that's why they pay physicians so much money to go out to work in those areas, because they don't have enough physicians in general. And so I do worry that that even if on a per case basis, we can see of hospitalized people, we start to see infection fatality rates decrease, the absolute numbers may continue to start to build and build and build, and certainly will, is that mortality is lagged always after incidents. And here I think we might be seeing two levels of removal. You might be having a lot of younger people getting infected like we saw in the summer, but eventually it catches up. All of those young people ultimately transmit to older individuals. We will see hospitals fill up more and more. We already are. And if that continues unabated, we are going to have a hard time functioning in our hospitals in this country.
Thank you.
Next question.
Hey, Michael, thanks for doing this. It's always really appreciated. So I wanted to ask you about a more sort of local question in our neck of the woods. Boston officials told us recently that they're going to start urging residents to get tested, whether or not they have symptoms, probably as frequently as they can, maybe every couple of weeks or so at city operated testing sites. I assume they're not expecting everyone in the city to do this, but would having more surveillance testing data, more than what they already have, empower health officials to do anything specific or make any specific intervention?
Yeah, it's a great question. It goes back. Who asked the first question? Was that I'm trying to remember in Miami. In any case, they it kind of goes together. This issue, I think we have to always remain cognizant of what the role of testing is and what our goals are. And you just said it very well, which is we have testing for clinical reasons. We have testing for surveillance. We have testing for screening, for entry, you know, to help make schools safer and things. And then we have testing for screening for public health to suppress outbreaks. A lot of what I've talked about is all the way over here, screening for public health to suppress outbreaks at a much larger level. So what you just suggested is surveillance. And that's exactly what it is. It's to survey the community to empower public health officials to be able to act. And if that is your goal, I do think that more surveillance testing is useful. It's not going to be any sort of silver bullet that will cause cases to dramatically be reduced. This sort of every once in a while drive-through testing, like the first question was about, and this one, isn't going to necessarily really cut down on cases at all in any appreciable way. But it will continue to inform public health officials so that they can better understand, do we need to make new rules? Can we lift regulations, or do we have to put more regulations in place and more lockdowns and things like that? And just to keep a pulse on things. So I think in that sense, this kind of more frequent testing can be very, or the drive-through testing and sort of opening it up to large numbers of people can be very useful. But I worry that sometimes that these messages are getting mixed up, that people actually think that sort of infrequent drive-through testing is a control strategy, but it's not. It's just it's an information strategy to keep public health officials in the know. But it's not really going to ever pull enough people out of the community to really make a dent. And that's where I think we've really lost track in many ways when it comes to contact tracing and what our real goals are. And it's why I've pushed so hard for frequent testing of large fractions of the population. Until you're testing large fractions of a population pretty frequently, say every week, you're going to barely find the people who you need to find when they're infectious. And so maybe you'll put a small dent, but really not change the course of things. So I think if the goal, like your question asked, is to inform policy decisions, then yes, more testing at these drive-through sites, even if infrequent per person, is very reasonable. I would say that you could probably do similar things. You could get similar effects by monitoring sewage and wastewater. So if our goal is just to inform policymakers, then maybe there should be more of a focus on those types of, like, doing that very frequently in the sewers, just to keep a pulse on what's happening at the community, and then really continue to offer drive-through sites for symptomatic people or people who believe that they've been exposed, so that we give people some access to testing. And then over on the other end, you know, eventually maybe we'll see enough of rapid tests to become available that people can actually frequently test on a regular basis and find themselves as positive before they have symptoms, before they have a chance to infect others.
No, I want to ask you, I think a large, very large proportion of the Massachusetts population hasn't ever gotten a COVID-19 test or a coronavirus test. How do you actually get people to use these sites, even if they're already, you know, free and available for appointments or walk-ins?
Yeah, well, this is a massive problem. I don't think you can easily. I've never been tested officially through one of these sites. I have access to rapid tests myself, but and the only reason is because, I mean, the real reason for me is because I never leave this chair, apparently. you know, it's inconvenient. It's very inconvenient. You can't expect huge portions of the population to be going through these rapid testing sites and talk about creating, disparities. There's clear disparities in terms of, you can't expect low-income individuals who are already working huge hours, who are taking public transit, to be able to go to a drive-thru. If you don't have a car, you don't go to a drive-thru. You know, these types of things. So I think I am not particularly fond of the drive-thru setup in how it's set up right now. I think it's needed to a certain extent. It's better than walking into a physician's office. So it's needed for symptomatic and potentially exposed people to have that option. How to get the average daily person to go, I really don't think that we'll ever be able to scale it up unless you really get these things. You have to be putting them on corners, have people just be sitting out on corners and in different areas and you know, with booths and things like that. You could potentially do that. You could actually set up booths, or you can, you know, if we as a country wanted to actually take this virus seriously, we could start producing tens of millions of rapid tests and get them into people's homes, work with county officials, state officials, and the federal government to get these tests directly to people so that they can use them every few days. You can have families all pool their samples together, for example, so that one test would, or two tests would give 10 tests worth of information in a week. So we can do this in different ways. I think the drive-through is a stopgap. But let's be real, the drive-through testing is for wealthy people, you know, or people with means to at least be able to do it, and with the wherewithal to figure out where to go. It's not that easy to figure out where are these testing sites. We should be plastering it all over all the messaging. You know, everything about this epidemic could really use a good dose of marketing expertise, and I don't know why. You know, it's just traditionally public health has been so separate from industry, but we really should be banking on, and heck, if we're going to use the Defense Productions Act to buy Abbott Bionics now, we should use the Defense Productions Act to get the funding to hire Coca-Cola's marketing team. I've said it a bunch, but I'm not saying it in jest. We really need the best of the best to figure out how to get messages across about how to work in a pandemic together, how to find sites that are that can test people, some that don't need cars, some that do. You know, all of this needs to be coordinated. And the real problem here is that there's no coordination. It's hard. It's hard for the average person to figure out just how to get a test. And that should not be the case at this point.
All right, thanks so much.
Next question.
Hi, actually, it's a good segue. I wanted to pick up on that because at the beginning of the call, you said there are no good choices facing us right now. And I don't know if you saw, but during last night's debate, they asked both candidates their plans for combating the coronavirus in 2021. And I sort of, if you watched, I'm curious for your take on what you saw, but also what you would advise the country, or, you know, if you were in the White House, the president, to do in 2021. Is it about marketing? Do we have the resources to send tests home? What or do we have no good choices and we should all just put our heads down for a year?
We have very good choices. We have to make those. We like things aren't just going to materialize for this pandemic for us to get life back to normal. We have good choices if we chose to act now. We could have acted a few months ago and had good choices at our hands now. We could act now and have good choices come January or December maybe. And those would be, you know, we don't have a vaccine and we can't necessarily rely on a vaccine. I think that the hope and the expectation for a vaccine has effectively paralyzed effective control of this virus. It has been the piece that a lot of people have chosen to rest on their laurels with and say, we're doing all we can, we're trying to get a vaccine. That's not all we can. Closures aren't all we can do. If in the current state of things, we don't have a lot of good choices, but we could. We know how to build. I truly believe that frequent testing, giving enough people in the community access to know their status, can stop spread of this virus. It can actually bring the R value down below one and get outbreaks to become suppressed, to stop growing, turn around, and get down towards zero. That is a good outcome. And it's based on the exact same principle that we're hoping for with vaccines, but we don't know if vaccines will create, which is herd effects. We're all hoping that the vaccines will create herd immunity. But there's a few problems with that. First, there's no way, I mean, it's impossible for the vaccine to create herd immunity until we get enough of them out. We know that we're not going to have enough vaccines out to the whole population, at least until late spring, early summer of 2021. We just know that. And regardless of how well they work, they're just not going to become widely available yet. And so we can't bank on herd immunity coming about anytime really soon, but we could drive herd effects, which would have the same effect as herd immunity through frequent rapid testing. And the nice thing is, you know, we have to, again, message them appropriately. We have to do everything appropriate, but we can actually cause herd effects. We can get R to drop below one in the same way that we hope vaccines would, but we just have to build them. And so this, thus far with this pandemic, we have seen the federal government just kind of sit by and wait for one company after another to come up with a new test, and then the feds just buy it. But there hasn't been ingenuity to actually develop it ourselves. I can't stop thinking about the analogy of if this was a war and it was missiles that are causing 230,000 Americans or more to die, we wouldn't be, you know, the idea of going just for herd immunity through natural herd immunity would be like us sitting in our homes while bombs are dropping on us and saying, well, it's okay, eventually the bombs are they're gonna run out of bombs, you know, but let's just let them keep hitting us right now because eventually they'll run out. Like, that's what herd immunity is. And our decision to just wait for companies to come up and for us not to actually create our own defenses or offenses is akin to us all just kind of going underground and saying, well, let them bomb our houses, let them bomb everything. You know, we'll just wait it out and wait until maybe we come up with some avenue for defense. We would never do either of those. If this was any sort of actual war that was killing 200,000 people, we would, as a country, be building bombers, we'd be building missiles, we'd be doing things that cost 1,000 times more than, or 100 times more than these rapid tests would. And rapid tests would be just extraordinarily cheap, $20 billion, and we could have almost enough rapid tests to cover large fractions of the United States and actually stop these epidemics, get everyone can test themselves on a daily basis if they want. That's what we should be doing. And I don't remember what the question was anymore, but I'm just so frustrated that we're not acting. You know, we're just keep asking the question, is it too late? Is there anything, are there any good choices? There continues to be a good choice in front of us. Testing is one thing we know can stop outbreaks. It's why we've put focus on it. We've just put the wrong focus on the wrong type of test. the only way we can really achieve herd effects through testing and suppress outbreaks is not through these drive-through tests where some people get tested once every few months. It's through getting people tested on a frequent basis and stopping people from spreading to others. Simple, simple math. And we have it within our grasp to build these. They're not difficult to build. They're just not. And we have the technology. It's proven now that it works. We have to get messaging on board. We have to, there's little things that we have to deal with along the way, but it can be done. But we haven't seen anyone really take any action to do it.
What do you see the next few months or 12 months look like if we go the other way, like Florida is doing right now with not quite herd immunity, but this idea of we protect the most vulnerable as best we can, seniors, what have you, and just let everybody else go about their business? Obviously, that's something that's been talked about in the White House. I think we are seeing it in Florida, even if they're not calling it that, which is obviously a big state. What happens, in your opinion?
Well, I think we can decide as a country to go that direction, but we have to be okay with another 200,000 people dying or more. And so if we're okay with coming out of 2021 saying that epidemic wasn't so bad, we're all immune, we had 500,000 people die or more. I think 500,000 would be the lower limit, would be absolutely the lower limit of deaths if we were to just kind of let this thing spread. It could be 2 million. I mean, I don't know exactly the number, but if we're okay with looking at ourselves and saying, my mom had another 20 years left of life, but, she passed away because of COVID. But she was older, so whatever. If we're okay saying that to 500,000 people or more, then okay, let's do that. Let's go that direction. Let's open everything back up, pull the Band-Aid off quick. I don't feel okay. So I think that we have other options at our disposal. But the longer we let it go without grappling with what those other options are and bringing them to the table, the more and more likely it is that we're going to just eventually throw up our hands and say, okay, the economic costs are becoming much worse than the viral costs. The mental health problems associated with shutting down are becoming much worse than the deaths associated with the virus. So the longer we go with inaction, the closer we're getting to the trade-offs just become worse and worse and worse. And eventually we are going to get to a place where we say, you know what, let's just go with herd immunity because, for a number of reasons, but it doesn't have to go that way. We just keep, but we are certainly painting ourselves into that corner. And I think, I have still not seen any evidence that we can really keep this virus in any serious way out of senior living facilities, out of people's homes. We keep saying older people, but 70 years old is not that old. It's not young, but it's not old. Many people who are 70 have 2 decades or more left of life. And I don't know, do we just tell everyone who's 65 and above and everyone with diabetes and everyone who's overweight to just not go outside during those periods of time? I don't buy it. I think that I just don't see it as a viable solution.
Thank you.
Dr. Minna, we have about 5-10 minutes left. And we have 3 questions left. So just want to give you a heads up. Next question.
Hi, thanks for taking the time to hold this. I wanted to ask you first just about using PCR or other tests to effectively test out of needing to be quarantined or isolated. How should we be thinking about that? There's some government efforts ongoing to study that.
Yeah, it's a really good question, and I've had quite a few discussions with the CDC on this issue, and with the question of testing at a quarantine becomes, I think, maybe most important for places like institutions where people live in dorms, like universities, and other areas where people have very limited space. So quarantining for 14 days isn't the end of the world if you have a nice big house and a yard and things like that. But when you live in a dorm, quarantining can be terrible. I mean, 14 days inside of a little white box, it's, you know, it's really terrible. So I've been working to try to figure out, can we safely get people out of quarantine earlier? Does it need to, do we have to wait for 14 days? And this idea of 14 days is, it's not arbitrary, but it's also, you know, what we're trying to figure out is how many people who are in quarantine A actually do become infected. What fraction of people become infected, which helps us better understand the trade-offs. And then when do they become positive? If we're testing people during quarantine, do most of them become positive in the first 3 or 4 days? And it's like an exceedingly small number of people who become positive after day 10. My guess is it's going to be very, very, very limited number of people who become positive after day 10. And likely still a very small fraction who become positive after day 7 or 8. So I think that if we could create the testing infrastructure so that people who do go into quarantine could get tested at say day 6 and they're negative. And then, you know, maybe then you can actually say to people, you can leave quarantine after day 6 if you have a negative result, if you adhere extremely well to social distancing and masks. And of course, quarantining is kind of just an extreme version of social distancing. So you still want to keep people wearing masks, social distancing as absolutely much as possible, recognizing that they might become positive. And also adding on top of it, especially now that we are seeing antigen tests become available, have these people maybe use an antigen test potentially every single day for the next week after they come out of quarantine. You know, something like that would be, I think, would start to err on a pretty safe way to get people out of quarantine earlier, and have an appropriate balance. Otherwise, I think we'll just end up seeing people start to leave quarantine just because they don't want to sit there anymore, especially people who might be in their second quarantine and in high risk areas where in communities where multiple people in somebody's social circle get infected. Some people might have to go into quarantine for two or three times. You know, so that's a month and a half of sitting in quarantine for people who have to go in for 3 times. So the quicker we can get people out, the better. I think there are ways to do it. And in particular, university campuses where the quarantining is particularly detrimental to students' mental health. These are also places which have the means usually or the resources to figure out how to test people to get them out of quarantine more readily. And so we're trying to collect the data to verify that that's an okay approach.
Do you have a follow-up?
Yeah, and I assume you mean the test at day 6, that would be a PCR test, right?
Ideally, but it could be either. I think especially if you're going to confirm that, if you're going to assure that somebody can take a test at day 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, for example, you know, I think that these, if it's what you have access to, I think the antigen tests are really doing very, very well. And so I think that those can be used as well.
Sorry, one more question here. On a sort of related subject, you know, using antigen tests to screen asymptomatic people has become kind of a contentious, you know, subject. You know, is that a bad idea? And if so, why? You know, I think we've seen them be talked about in as most useful in a setting where you're really screening people. So as we see them getting rolled out more widely, you know, how should we be thinking about this issue?
Yeah, well, the positive predictive value goes down if you have no reason to believe somebody's infected. And so these will have false positives. So you have to always associate a rapid antigen test with a confirmatory rapid test. You want to be able to confirm them right then and there. If somebody's positive on this and negative on that, then you want to be able to say, hey, false positive, don't worry about it. Or we think this might be a false positive, test again tomorrow to ensure that it is, but maybe today isolate anyway. So there's approaches there. These tests, I think, are most useful for asymptomatic screening if used frequently, again, because they can actually create herd effects. Short of that, are they, if we can scale them up to 100 times the number of tests we're currently doing in the country, then sure, use them for asymptomatic screening. There's no problem with that. Even if not being used by the same individual over and over and over twice a week. I think that it will, they do a good job a very good job at detecting people when they have enough virus to transmit. And so if it's that or no test, then use the test. And it has to come. A lot of people say people are going to interpret it poorly and use it as a ticket to go and party. We just have to create the messaging to make sure people understand what a negative means and what a positive means. But this is the same with all of these tests. A negative never means assures that it's a negative, but a positive, especially on an antigen test, can almost assure that you definitely should isolate and that you're currently infectious. And so I think we just need to really understand what role these tests have. And I want them to be used primarily if you're using them for kind of entry screening, where people are using it to say go to school or go to a restaurant. They should be mostly used to as an indicator of who not to let in, but not as an indicator of who to let in, if that makes sense.
Okay, thank you.
Next question.
So therapies reduce death. You say that doesn't matter because hospitals, they still need to be hospitalized. But in fact, remdesivir shortens hospital stays to 10 days from 15. That's New England Journal of Medicine. The primary endpoints for the vaccines are reduction of symptoms by 60%. Who knows if we'll get there, but that if we do, that would shorten hospital stays. And then the Regeneron, as Trump calls it, also shortens stays, but not by that much, but still by some amount. Anyway, don't the therapies like reduce the hospital burden too, as opposed to just the death rate?
Yeah, they do. And so we would have to look at the balanced heart. We would have to take a good hard look at that balance and say, you know, can we get into an equilibrium where we're getting people out quick enough from the hospital to accommodate the filling up of the hospital? And so are we reducing stays fast enough? But the fact is, in a lot of the United States, hospitals are often already kind of near their limit. And so an additional huge number of people, even if you can get them out a little bit quicker, can still runs a serious risk of overburdening the system. And so I would say that those pieces will absolutely help. I think if we could scale those drugs up, in particular the monoclonal antibodies, you know, those could technically be used in a whole different light, where they could be used prophylactically, especially depending on their half-life, how long they take to be cleared from the body. Now, maybe you can actually give those not once somebody becomes sick enough to require them, but they're, you know, one of the nice things about monoclonal antibodies like Regeneron or Eli Lilly is that they could potentially be used almost as a vaccine, where you give them before exposure and hope that that actually prevents people from ever even getting a symptomatic infection. So there are ways that we could also use some of these therapies that are now coming about to, like you ask, really decrease the burden on the hospitals.
Okay, and if you got to go, you got to go. I get it. I can ask next week if you're on. But I never heard the phrase herd effects before through frequent testing. Can you give us a little more on that? Or if you want to wait till next week, that's fine. But...
In short, it's that's what this whole plan that I've been talking about for months is. That's what my research has been about. It's to, if you can get enough people to know early enough that they are exposed and infected so that they stop their own transmission from propagating, and you can get just say 40% of a population to be able to use these tests appropriately in a community every week or twice a week, you can, all of our mathematical models suggest that we can really sever enough transmission chains that we essentially pull the fuel out of the fire. We stop the momentum of the outbreak. The curve turns over very quickly, and it leads to herd effects. It's actually the exact same way that herd immunity works to create herd effects.
Got it.
Only it's,
I never heard it called that before, but I understand your point there. Thanks.
Yeah. Yeah, and you can look up, I had a New England Journal of Medicine paper on it just 2 weeks ago, I think. And then we have another paper coming out soon that really describes it mathematically.
Excellent. Thank you for your time.
Sure.
This concludes the October 23rd press conference.